Welcome back to The Growth Signal. My name is Alyssa Nolte.
And I'm Anthony DeShazer.
And we are going to get right into it. So tell us, Anthony, what is your hot take?
The biggest mistake I see companies make today is that they allow their customers to define value.
Okay, you have to tell me more about this because I just had a conversation. I don't even know if the episode went live yet. But the idea of like, I think it was maybe even the opposite take that you don't get to define value, your customer does. So I can't wait for this head to head. So let's dive in. Tell us more.
So I learned this the hard way. I was the chief customer officer of a third-party software firm. And we solved tickets. We provided support for Oracle's, the SAPs, at half the price of the vendor or more. I don't know what they're doing today, but that's what the pitch was when I was there. Here's the problem. That wasn't all we did. We actually did a lot more. We were proactive. We helped their systems become more stable. We improved the performance. We prevented cases. But that's where the conflict became, or the conflict arise. Customers, any CIO will tell you, they measure the effectiveness of support by cost per ticket. How much does it cost us to solve this ticket or these sets of tickets? Well, if we're making the systems more stable, if we're making them perform better, the number of tickets would decrease as the customer stayed with us longer, which meant we would provide more value for their company, but the core metric would not reflect that value. In fact, it would go the opposite direction. The cost per ticket would increase because we prevented the tickets from even being entered.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because when you take out the divisible, right, and all of a sudden you have less tickets, but the cost has stayed the same, like then it looks bad, right? Simple math, right? We're talking about going back to school and doing a back to school algebra test. Like, it's simple math. If you have less tickets, but your costs stay the same, then your cost per ticket's going to go up.
And so that metric caused a lot of issues during renewals.
Yeah.
It was contraction. It was churn pressures. It was a place where as a CCO, I have to admit, I didn't do well my first year. The second year was the pandemic when we started to make that pivot. But it was very, very hard in those retention battles because of that. The cost per ticket was going in the wrong direction. So we had to make a pivot. We had to change.
It's interesting, too, because it's not so much that like your customer is not defining value because they've created this thing in their mind of like, this is what we value. But it's almost like you need to make sure that what they value and what you deliver are not in conflict, right? Because you are delivering something that maybe they didn't realize was value. Maybe they didn't actively track it as value. But it's really not fair when you're delivering in other areas that are valuable and yet you're not getting credit for that because it doesn't show up on some random dashboard that they've created.
Absolutely. The thing that you have to, at least my new view of this, is that you define value, but you have to connect it to what the customer sees as value. So you don't go in and tell your customer you're wrong. That's the wrong metric. It's a yes and. Yes, your cost per ticket is increasing, but here's why. And here's how that's a good thing. So we had to go through and define value broader than our customers defined it. So we can then bring in the full impact we're delivering. They were focused, largely it was a positioning. We were, you know, victims of our own success. We talked about how much we saved. That was the whole, you know, the whole positioning to get them in the door. We save you money. Well, that positioning to get them in the door actually fought against us in retention. So we had to, in the process, redefine value so that we can have the conversation about the true, you know, impact we're delivering.
In your opinion, how important was setting that expectation from go in terms of like, hey, just an FYI, a year from now, your cost per ticket is going to go up. Here's why that's a good thing, right? Projecting into the future rather than trying to, cover for it after the fact.
Well, since then, I've worked with several different companies, and I can tell you the answer is in an ideal world, it'll be up from day one. But the reality is often quite different. You know, when you're marketing to customers, you have to get the signal to them that gets them to buy. that's reality. And if, depending on the season, it might be the cost savings. Mm-hmm. And so you lean heavily into pre-sales and doing sales on that value, because that's the metric that's going to get them to actually sign. It's now up to the rest of the company to go through the change management over time to get them to understand the true value of what you deliver. So it's if you can get it done the first, you know, up front where they understand the value, they're using that same metric that they'll see throughout, that's ideal. But the reality is customer acquisition is different than customer retention and expansion. So sometimes you will lean on different aspects of your value proposition to accomplish different tasks. Your job as a customer leader, as a customer revenue leader, is being able to do that translation. You have to be able to do it.
I love that you bring up change management in particular, because I see far too many companies either skip it entirely, they ignore it and pretend like, you know, oh, they'll just figure it out. Our software's so intuitive and useful, they're going to find it out right away. Or what is maybe potentially even worse, they do it halfway. Like they kind of do it, they get into it, and then when the real, like when the dip comes, they're like, okay, well, we're going to move on now because we don't want to go through that hardship of like the relearning curve that happens.
Yeah. One of the things that I've learned over the years is onboarding is an ongoing thing. It never stops. There's the official onboarding when you first get them, but if you're a good CSM or if you are a CCO or someone that's driving that retention banner and that expansion banner, you have to realize you got to have triggers to realize or to start that onboarding playbook again. It's like, oh, wait, we have new people coming in. They don't quite understand our full value. Let's go in and make sure they understand it. We resell our value. And I think that's where I think the second problem I see customers make is to your point, or companies make, is that they go in, go through onboarding once, think it's done, and then they're not prepared when their champion leaves, or there's a new CEO hired, a new CIO comes on, or new members of the executive or even frontline staff come onto the team. You have to constantly be mindful of the change management that's necessary. As companies evolve, you just have to be always have your thumb on the pulse of that.
How much do you think that is a reflection of the times that we live in? Like, not to sound like an old person, but like back in my day, like things didn't change this fast. I feel like the rate of change of things that I have to learn or think about or understand or be able to integrate into my company, whether it's, you know, with the people that are always changing or the tools that are always changing, it just feels like the rate of change is so accelerated these days. And there's so much distraction and noise in the market that I feel like I have to like always be in front of my customers or they will forget I exist.
I have the same challenge, but I agree with you. I absolutely agree with you. Things are moving faster and they're not slowing down. AI is accelerating everything from product development to even how marketing works. And in some cases, even how sales and customer success works. It's going to move faster. But here's what I think is also going to happen. As it moves faster, the tenure of the executives are going to get shorter.
Yeah, I think so.
Just simply is the case. It's going to, you know, right now, the revenue team at most companies only lasts 18 to 24 months. That means the CRO, CCO, CMO, it really, you know, we got a 2-year lifespan, so to speak, at most companies. And I think that's going to reduce as AI continues to move forward. That means we have to constantly resell, manage change, because it's going to happen. It's just going to happen more frequently.
So if and I agree with you, if that's the reality. If I'm sitting here and listening to this, I'm a CS leader, and I hear the actually kind of frankly terrifying that my champion, my customer, my buyer might only be at the place that I sold into 18 to 24 months total. And so if I sold in, you know, after a year that they've been there, maybe I only have 6 months to a year left of their relationship. How do we lead with this change? How do we stop the bleed as vendors? And how do we make sure that we do re-onboard our customers repeatedly without annoying them?
The key part to me is when you have to be multi-threaded within the organization. we're beyond the days where you have that one champion or that one economic buyer for 40 years. That doesn't exist anymore. And so you have to be multi-threaded. So you'll have those antennae within the company that can alert you to when change happens. And you'll have a backup in case your champion does leave. Do you have someone else that can step in potentially, or at least then navigate you to the new champion? So you got to be multi-threaded within the organization. The second piece, you have to be trigger motivated versus constant. One of the greatest impacts I think AI is going to have on customer success and customer experience is that our journeys will stop being linear and be more event-based. And so now you have an agent or you have the data to let you know, hey, I need to run this change management play, or I need to do this with this individual, this set of people, versus constantly hammering your customers. So it's not about touching them all the time. Is touching them at the right time with the right message. So what data, what signals do you have or can you build to let you know when's the right time and who's the right target for this message?
One of the things I like to talk about is this concept that I call manufactured serendipity. How do you create these opportunities that feel like serendipity, but are really carefully calculated, understood, data-driven approaches, triggers, if you will, to making sure that you are in the right place at the right time with the right message. And if you are only reading public news about your customer, you already missed the boat, because what they're saying publicly is like how many weeks behind what they're saying privately.
That is so true. And I love the tools that are out there now that allow you to mine all the data that's publicly available about your customer. The tools that can go out and consume all that, summarize it for you and make it actionable for you, that's great. But you're so spot on with this, is that by the time you get that data, it's already stale.
Mm-hmm.
Because they've been talking about this internally before they ever made it public. So you have to have those pathways within the organizations, those whisper campaigns, have those I call it backroom conversations, where you can be at a conference with someone and take them out to lunch or dinner or even have coffee, and they tell you what's actually going on within the overall company. That's why you have to be multi-threaded, because you're not going to get that from just a single source. You need to have multiple people you can talk to and triangulate what is the truth. What's the unspoken, that hidden truth that's there? This, I believe, is where customer success and sales, the individuals, the people, need to lean into, because AI can't do that yet. And I think it'd be a long time before AI can do that, have those human conversations that allow you to hear what's not being said.
I want to go back to your comment about like people are only staying for 18 to 24 months, because if that's true for the customers that you're selling to, that's probably also true for your team members as well, for the company that you're trying to build. So how do we prevent all of that knowledge and experience and understanding of the customer from being totally lost when someone moves on to a new role?
This is where you have to build systems. We're beyond the dates or the stage where people can rely or companies can rely on heroes. There should be no more supermen or superwomen in your team. Yep, you can have your top performers, but if you're relying on these one or two people to carry your entire team, you're not being an effective leader. Yes, that might be okay for a stage of where you are, but you should be actively working to get out of that. Yeah. And so you have to build systems. How do you get your top performers and everyone to enter their data, enter their intelligence, into a central place so it's not lost? I always, you know, when I lead companies or lead teams, I make the old joke that tells you how old I am. It's now, hey, what's going to happen if you get hit by a bus tomorrow?
So, you know, I come from the startup world. So we're always like maybe too nimble sometimes, maybe too reactive to what we're seeing and hearing. But my business partner and I actually had the hit by a bus binder that we kept in the trunk of our cars. And it was a physical binder that had all the details about the company, you know, all of our passwords, all of that stuff, you know, what to do, where the bills come from and all that stuff. And all of our families knew in the trunks of our car were our hit by a bus binders, because what happens if you're hit by a bus, right? My fear, though, is that with everything going on, number one, salespeople are notoriously bad at data entry of any kind, and any of that kind of thing. So how do we make sure that we are either A, giving the time and space and incentivizing the behavior to get people to fill in these things to make sure that we understand our customers, that we aren't losing this information? Or are there systems in place that we can say, you know, just they're more passive, right? They just exist in the background while you go do your job. And we're not going to ask you to do data entry because you're bad at it anyway.
You have to do three things, I believe. One, you have to have adequate capacity planning. Understand that administrative tasks are there. You should try to minimize them, but they are part of the job. You just have to do it. So you have to build in time for people to do it. Second thing you have to do is make sure, to your point, you have the right incentives to make it happen. To a certain degree, we're all coin operated. We really are. And so make it part of their base comp. You know, hey, listen, what's your Salesforce hygiene or your HubSpot hygiene? Hey, we did an inspection and you have data about this deal that's not available in any of our systems. Let's ding you for that. Or let's reward you for the times you do have everything in the systems. You have to reward for it. Then the third, you have to build tools and systems to ease the effort. If something is difficult, people are less likely to do it. So if you can get systems that can operate in the background, for example, I love all the CRM tools right now. My favorite CRM to date is HubSpot. I've used Salesforce, but for my own, you know, little practice I have now, HubSpot's the king. I love the fact that it can read my emails. Hey, and if I'm emailing a contact that I'm negotiating with or whatever is happening there, it can capture that for me and I don't have to go transcribe that into the tool. The tool's already doing it for me. I've worked with companies now that use AI to do this, where it's not just, hey, let me go and read your email, but I'm looking at your email. I'm getting the transcripts from all your Zoom calls. I'm looking at every text message you send because you've connected your phone with me and you've given me the ability to read all your messages. And now I can go build everything we need to keep this data accurate. So the passive systems, if you can build them, are going to be essential to helping with compliance. If you do all three, I think you can build something that may not be 90%, maybe 85%, but that's better than zero.
What do you think is the biggest blind spot that customers have when it comes to successfully, not customers, that people have, like who are trying to run a practice, when it comes to figuring out how to successfully define value?
They don't know the problem they're solving. They're not certain, they waffle, or they're not clear on what is the problem we're solving. Oftentimes when I see companies make a mistake, it's because they focus on, we're solving this problem for this customer. So now you've narrowed in your overall problem space to what this customer is telling you. And that to me is like chasing a customer's approval. You don't want customers' approval. You want their retention. You want to earn the right to expand. Having a customer like me is important, but it's not critical. You can hate me, but if I'm making you successful, you're probably going to still work with me. Some of my best customers are customers that we had a very adversarial relationship with. We argued almost every time we got on the phone, but they stayed for 4 years.
And that's so counterintuitive to like the attitude that I think a lot of people in CS roles tend to have is like, well, we're friends. They like me. You know, we talk about our dogs. It's great. Right. And then they're blindsided when that renewal doesn't come.
I've had customers leave and still recommended us.
Right.
They love us, but they still left.
So right. It doesn't matter how much they love you if they're leaving.
If they're leaving, it doesn't matter. I mean, yes, they may help you win them back, but it doesn't help your numbers this quarter because they bailed, they churned. And so you have to be very, very secure on what is the problem you're solving. And for most companies, it's not a single problem. You have several things that you provide or several problems you solve, but you need to be able to phrase that in a single sentence. That sentence has to be, it can be a complex sentence. I like using jobs to be done as my foundation for defining the problem, but it needs to be something that is in one sentence. Once you have that, you now can figure out how do customers know when we're doing this job well, when we're solving this problem. What are those metrics? What are those, if you're using jobs to be done, it's like, what are my minimizing statements? What are my outcome statements that I want to write that lets me know that we're doing this job well? Those outcome statements are key candidates for value metrics. And so you start with the problem and you build your value, and then you build the product that continues to reinforce that value.
I think one of the things too, as you were talking, that I think people miss is they might have a really clear understanding of their problem, and they might even be pretty good at saying like, this is the problem that we solve, but they forget to connect it to the signal that the customer can see without having to be told that this is working, right? Like if you are the only one who can say, by the way, it's working, and aren't you happy with that? Then that's not good. They need to be the ones to say, hey, Alyssa, hey, Anthony, this thing you sold me, it's working. And I can't be the one who says that for them. They have to see it and feel it and experience it, whether it's even real or not, but they have to have that thought that it is.
I think most companies forget your product is often your best channel for communicating value. I mean, I look at Amazon, and I'm not saying Amazon's the best, but if you're an Amazon Prime user, you go into Amazon and it tells you how much money you've saved with Amazon Prime. It tells you. And then when it's time to renew it, it clearly says you save X amount of dollars with Amazon Prime. And here's how much we're asking for a renewal.
Right. And if you don't renew, you're not going to save this money anymore. Like it's an easy decision.
It's fear of missing out. And it makes their renewal costs seem absolutely minuscule.
Yeah.
Now, I don't know if that metric of how much money I've saved, how real it is or not. I really don't know.
I don't know either.
But it's the fact that they have a metric and they're constantly showing it to me.
Yeah. And it's not just on renewal, though. When I log into my account and I go to like my orders tab, it's right there all the time, always in my face. And I don't really pay attention to it, to be honest with you. Until I need to, or until someone brings it up. Because when you just said that, I'm like, oh yeah, I have saved several thousand dollars because I order everything from Amazon.
So do I.
Which but I love it. Just comes to my house.
This is where I think B2B companies need to learn from B2C companies. Because in a B2C world, you rely heavily on your product and your marketing. You don't have salespeople that can go out, at least not enough, to go and deal with individual consumers. In B2B, we tend to forget that. I mean, I think we forget that companies don't buy software. People buy software for the company they work for. So we think we're talking to a company as an entity of itself. In reality, we're talking to individuals who act on behalf of the company. And if you keep that focus, every B2B conversation is actually a B2C. You're talking to a specific user, a particular person. That's just one element of that organism called the company. And if you keep that view, then you'll understand, hey, this is the value we deliver, but how do I communicate that value to that individual so they can communicate internally to whomever they need to so I can get my renewal? I mean, that's one of the things where I think, you know, besides making the mistake of letting your customers define value, the second mistake is they assume value is the same for every person in your organization.
Yeah.
It's not true.
Yeah. We're much more personal. Individual. We're more individual, even in a B2B monolith where, you know, and maybe back in the old day, you only had so many choices and like you sold to the B2B and you sold to one decision maker who was there for 40 years. And then, you know, you were the incumbent or whatever. But I think you're right, especially too, as those individuals change and morph so rapidly and with the turnover of the people who are working there, you really have to have a good understanding. And that is one of the benefits. If you take a B2C mindset with the advantages of multi-threading in a B2B, you'll be unbeatable.
Absolutely. I think in my last company, this was proven. We were an outcome-based company with a zero notice termination clause. They could leave without even, you know, even letting us know. So our customers could leave at any point, but we had a high retention rate. And it's because when we communicated value, we understood the persona. Who's this person? We may not know them individually, but we know them by the persona, by the role they play in our product. And so if we know that role, what do we need to communicate, you know, to them so they saw value? So for example, as we're talking to, it's a fundraising or a donation platform. So if we're talking to the chief strategists around fundraising strategists, okay, so let's talk big picture with them. But if we're now talking to the accounting person who has to go in and very task oriented, all they're wanting to do is reconcile all the numbers, they don't necessarily care about the big picture. They want to know, how are you helping me do my job? And so how do I communicate that to them and then potentially connect it to the big picture? But maybe not. It depends on the persona. That's the extra work that I think. But I think I'm a true believer that that pays off. When you can communicate value all the way down to the persona level and connect it all the way back up, that's how you truly win.
Thinking about, you know, all of the people that you know or aspire to know, who is leading the charge? Who is doing this better than anyone else?
So there are a couple of people that I've connected with recently. One's by the name of Nick Rodriguez. He works at GitHub. He has an extensive background working for major consultancies, but he and I had a great conversation last week in which we both reminisced about this issue, about customers, just companies making the mistake of letting their customers define value. So I think he's someone, if you're out there and you want to talk value, he is a great person to go talk to. There's a product out there that I also like because it's doing similar things, and it's called Ecosystems around value communication. How do you capture and manage value? I'm not associated with them. Don't tell it. So go follow it if you want to or not. But I do like their customer value community, where you get a like-minded people talking about value and sharing stories of just like this one that I just shared. Like, how do you really define value? And so those are some people that I think you should follow, or some organizations that you should follow and communities you can join if you're interested in how do you define and deliver value to customers.
And if someone is hearing this and they're really connecting with you, they want to learn more, they want to follow along, where can they find you online?
So you can always find me on LinkedIn. It's Anthony DeShazor, ADESHAZOR on LinkedIn, and you can find me.
Awesome. Well, I am connected with Anthony, so I can vouch that he is a great follow. So make sure you're following him on LinkedIn. Make sure you reach out. Let him know that the Growth Signal sent you. And we are so excited to continue this conversation. Anthony, thank you so much for joining me on the Growth Signal.
Great conversation.